Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Guys, welcome back to Magic TV. It is 9 o'clock on a Tuesday, which means it's time for Talk Magic. It is episode 8, and I am here with Daniel Chard, who I consider to be the greatest card magician in the world today. Absolutely without question. Hey, Daniel, how you doing?
I'm doing very good. I appreciate the sentiment.
It's true. It's true. I mean, I've known you for a long time. But the stuff that you do with playing cards, and I'm okay with a pack of cards, but, you know, we've gigged together, we've gone to gigs together, I've watched you perform to real people, and the stuff that you do with cards, you do stuff for real people with playing cards that everybody else considers to be pipe dreams. And it's just, you know, I don't want to blow your own trumpet too much when I tell you that it's almost like poetry in motion. Which is why I wanted to have you on the channel, because, you know, you are so skillful and you are so entertaining. So yeah, thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
I've got to do this justice and live up to those words.
I know you will. Well, you know what? For those people that don't know you, let's start at the very beginning. When did you get into magic? Look, was it something that you wanted to do from a young age? How did it all come about?
It's a great question. I mean, it's one of those things I've sort of postulated on for years, but I think I've got a sort of vague recollections of doing magic as a kid, like my grandparents buying me like magic sets. I guess it becomes like a cyclical thing. They all run out of gift ideas. So magic, you know, a magic set just at some point gets on that list. And then, yeah, I just became obsessed with it from there. It was such a... just learned it over the years. I got put on the back burner for a little bit. I'd show my mum and my parents the odd little trick here and there, but it really took off when I started to see I think there was a couple of kids in school that got into magic. You know most people get into it for a couple of weeks and then they leave it, but the stuff they showed me was like so damn good for like where they were. A guy could basically sleeve a coin, and I had no idea. He seemed to have like the right knack. It just blew my mind. And I think I saw a guy do the haunted deck with secret apparatus, should we say. And it just absolutely blew my mind. But he wouldn't tell me how it works. So our teacher basically took the deck of cards off him and sort of put it in her drawer. And it was he wouldn't tell me. So I had to wait till she went out of the class and kind of rummage through her drawers, which sounds really bad. And then find out how it worked, and just blew my mind. It was such a weird technical kind of apparatus to make something look like a deck of cards moved, right? And then, but my first real vivid memory, so I got obsessed with like card flourishes and practice for hours and hours a day when I was like 15. And then a magician I'm still friends with now, a guy called Richard Newman, he was at a youth center near me. And he was showing everyone magic. There was a massive crowd around him. I couldn't get to him. So I started practicing some flourishes. And he sort of out the corner of his eyes sort of lit up. And he was like, can you do that again? And I was just like, yeah, fine. Cause I did, I knew loads of flourishes, but I didn't really do much magic at that time. So I was about 13, 14 at that point. And then he showed me the Biddle trick. I still remember, you know, that feeling of like my world just like kind of shattering around me. I remember the card he did it with, I think it was like the Nine of Hearts, it's like a Black Tiger deck. And but yeah, literally ever since that point, it was that the fuel was there, but that was kind of the lighting of it that just made me obsessed with that point. And I'd spend, you know, every waking hour like getting DVDs, reading books on card stuff, just practicing, exploring. And yeah, that's never really hasn't really changed till now, I suppose.
And how did you gravitate to playing cards from the very beginning? Now, I know you do other stuff than cards, and we'll talk about that, but you are known primarily as a card guy. Yeah. How come it it was cards instead. I asked the same question to Michael Rubenstein in episode 3. Sure. I said, how come coins? What? Same question.
Yeah, yeah.
How come cards?
I've not seen his answer, but I presume it would just be the same. It was just a prop that felt right and natural in my hands. You know, it didn't, it felt like they were more of an extension of me than a prop per se. I've tried, like you said, I've tried magic with everything, you know, like ropes, coins, mentalism, propless. And, you know, some of it's good, some of it's good, but that's a whole different discussion. But I don't know. It's just one of those objects that I think I was kind of enamored by the amount of like infinite possibility you could do with them. You know, I've seen guys like Ricky J do a whole like hour show with just a deck of cards, and seeing some of the Spanish guys do their amazing stuff. It was just absolutely blew my mind. And it's, I suppose at the time they're cheap. Kind of, I think Ed Marlowe was asked in an interview, like, why cards? And he just said, because they were cheap. And it was, to some extent, that probably, so I do cards because of poverty in some respects. but yeah, just kept it going. And then here I am, I suppose. So,
so when did you turn professional? Was it early on in life, or was it?
When I was five, no. I think, no, it's kind of a real, real slow burn. Like not a, you know, you hear those stories of like overnight successes. This was like the complete opposite, the complete antithesis of that. Basically, I started doing the odd random gig here and there, you know, like 20 quid there, 50 quid there, just for like family friends that wanted to basically take advantage of a new, new young magician. And luckily when I was 18, Mark Bennett opened Illusions Magic Bar in Bristol. And it was me and a friend. I remember reading it on Magic Week purely by chance. They said, oh, there's a new magic bar opening in Bristol. And I thought, great, this sounds like an amazing opportunity. And then me and my friend auditioned, and we both got given a shift. And that was kind of like my first official gig or residency, if you like. And that lasted, I performed there on and off for about 11 years or so, I think.
I know your name, and we're going to talk about this, your name and Mark Bennett's name has been associated and linked together literally for as long back as I can remember.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, a huge part of my development is, you know, thanks to him. So I can't really thank him enough in that respect, because if it wasn't for the you know, those venues having the kind of appropriate place for us to perform, like night after night after night, like, you know, some of the hours were long and some of the shifts were really unforgiving, especially in the start. You know, it was purely like baptism through fire, because the bar kind of evolved over time. Like, it started off as like a makeshift performance bar just kind of in the corner, and then became its own established thing. And then, you know, it got added to all the time and became like in the end, it was like a real pleasure to perform there every week. It was never really a chore to answer the question. That kept going for like 7, 8, 9 years. And then I think I've been doing, well, I was full-time pro up until pre-COVID, I suppose. That was, so I think professionally about 5 years, but semi-professionally for about 12.
And you said that you got your first residency at Smoking Mirrors at the age of 18. How important would you say, how much of a difference did it make in your development as a magician, actually having a place to go out and perform? And I suppose I'm asking this, we have a lot of people on this channel who are new to magic. Sure. How important is it to go out and actually perform to people as opposed to just sitting there practicing this stuff?
Oh, it's everything. I think it's because you can conceptualize the moves and practice till the cows come home, but until you've actually done them in front of people, because obviously the mirror is forgiving, because you learn to operate within its blind spots, if you will. And then, you know, you can start to almost manipulate yourself by performing the right move at the right angle for the right situation. Whereas in the, you don't have anywhere near that level of control in the real world. As you know, there's so many things playing for attention, you know, like waiters, people's attentions, people conversing with each other. But to answer the question, it's everything. I think without that experience, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. Mm-hmm. So I think it's as soon as that you really need a place to like really die on your ass, you know, like to try something and just, I think the sooner, it's like a pivotal experience in some respects. Like the sooner you absolutely die on your ass, like, you know, we can all, I can envision like 2 or 3 or 4 sets where it's just like, where you feel like, not that you want to give up magic, but you were just like, that was so shit. And then that you're kind of at this tipping point. You're like, do I give up? You know, like, was everything I've done up until this point a complete waste of fucking time? Or are we allowed to swear?
Oh yeah, we are. Yeah.
Sure. Fine. Okay. And then it's a complete waste of fucking time up until now. Or, you know, is everything after this going to be a good investment of time if I carry on? But the thing seems to be like, for those that go past that and then continue to put themselves in those uncomfortable positions, it makes your learning curve just goes up. You know, you just go off the charts because you learn, especially in a residency, because you learn and adapt. Every you might learn a tiny nuance at table one, take that to table two and it doesn't work. You have to tweak it slightly. So every time you're doing that, you're building up a reference point for a future scenario. You might have, and then obviously if you take that over years and years and years, you've got all of these situations that you've been in and you're armed with like a tiny piece of knowledge that might be relevant, and you might not need it for another decade, you know, but it's in there. And absolutely. I think that's, so it's everything, I think.
And one thing I want to talk to you about a little bit later on is, sure, obviously because you work at Smoke and Mirrors, you've transitioned to stage magic. And I want to talk to you about that, Dan. Well, we can talk about it now. So you were primarily a close-up guy for a very, very 100%. Long time. And you've done what a lot of close-up guys have never actually been able to do, which is transition to be a stage performer. How important would you say it is to be able to actually perform on stage as a magician? And what advice can you give somebody who's done primarily close up their entire career and they're wanting to take that step to, you know, to do stage magic?
Sure. Obviously, again, like I said, with the venues, super lucky to have a stage at Smoke and Mirrors to then perform on. I think in regards to advice I'd give, I mean, I'm still kind of what I'd say, I'm in my like stage infancy in some respects. Like it's been, you know, a good 3-4 years, and but I still, because it's a whole new sort of genre of magic, I wouldn't necessarily say that I'd be in a position to give advice per se. The learning curve is steep, and you know, I'm still learning stuff literally every week, especially now, like we were saying before, like because we're in a situation now where you're forced to present stuff, you can't really have props like handed out. It forces the dynamic to change now. If that, if this kind of pandemic wouldn't have happened, would I have sort of explored that area of presenting? Probably not, because I was so comfortable in. So that's probably the first point I'd say, is that when I first started, most of my stuff was all cards. It was probably about 85% card material, and the best thing that I did, and obviously thanks to Mark in that respect as well. He'd always push me to try like new things, non-card stuff. Try, you know, like comedy magic in some respects. Like still a long way to go, but it's all stuff I wouldn't have tried if I didn't, you know. I think I went for the sort of opportunity, but he's pushed me to try all the new stuff. And the advice I'd give is, you know, you need to work on all the different stuff, try everything to see what your area of stage magic is, because I'm still experimenting with mine. Like it's probably a mix of like I wouldn't say mentalism, but more mind fun, you know, it's fun mind reading stuff as opposed to like too heavy. And because I was never that serious mentalist guy. I tried it for a little bit, just really didn't suit my personality, and it felt inauthentic. So I guess it's stuff that's authentic to you. Take magic that you already do and think of ways to make it play bigger. And obviously the great thing of technology now is that I explored that in my show, is having like a camera down in my hands and then doing card stuff to music. So there's so many, you know, I know that's not a grand leap forward. That's pretty standard in the close-up stuff now, but it was a huge leap. And I'm super thankful that I've done it, because there's so many crossover skills you pick up that you can then apply to close up. It could be misdirection. It's more like timing, misdirection, how to frame certain slights, or how to make effects play bigger. So many moving parts that I think it's a beneficial thing for anyone to go through.
And how important, you talked about, you tried mentalism, you weren't, that didn't suit you. How important is it to develop a character when you're performing, both on stage and close up? And you know, this is a question we get on the channel a lot. I got it on a recent Q&A. How would you go about developing a character? You know,
I think it depends on how the question's being asked. I think it's a, because this is kind of a, I can say that with relative certainty, because it's a, it's almost like a magic existential question that I've asked myself since, you know, the very beginning. I've always, in my head, always seen a character as this kind of, you know, caricatured version. In my head, I've always envisioned, when someone said, like, what is your character? I always thought you had to have like a wacky, zany kind of, you know, Looney Tunes style character. I assume that's what you'd have to, I thought that's what people were referring to. And it's only in the last, I don't know, 8 years that my, basically my character is me, essentially. It's so for, whether that's good or bad is yet to be decided, but it's just, I think every, anytime you perform magic on, you know, on stage or in person, you're just accentuating parts about yourself that you want to highlight, but also, you know, not, you want to hold stuff back that you think people may not like in some respects. But for me, the working with guys like Matt Wright and seeing, you know, characters that were larger than life, very animated, arguably very different to who they are as a person. So it's almost like a professional fiction in some respects. Like, they're very different on stage to how they are off stage. But for me, that was it's kind of too much hard work. So the advice I give is take the time to just work with like who you are as a person, you know, find out really, really like who you are, get self-aware, find out what makes you happy in, you know, outside of magic, and then apply that sort of thinking to magic as a, as you perform. I think people tend to over analyze the question, I think, you know, cause they want to create like a J.K. Rowling style Harry, you know, Harry Potter figure. They want this kind of Joseph Campbell, hero's journey, you know, they want this real powerful archetype, whereas if you just take who you are and just add it, you know, add, like John Gustafur said, add 1%, and the next time if you want to, if you felt that worked really well, maybe push it a tiny bit more, and then just you'll find a kind of point of like homeostasis where everything kind of comes together and just it fits. And for me, the day was, I was so everyone said to me like, oh, you should perform commercial stuff, you know, don't do all this finger flinging nonsense. And I was just like, oh, bollocks for that. But I took the advice for a long time. I started performing, I always performed stuff that people said I should. And then the day, I remember the shift like super vividly, it was at Illusions. And I just thought, right, scrap all that. And then did 20 minutes of like hard stuff that I really enjoy. And the reactions were, it was completely kind of unfathomable at that point, because they were just so much larger than anything I'd presented for that night, whether that was the drink, whether that was, you know, whether that was just the right circumstances, whether it was me having more fun because I was doing stuff that I wanted to present. You know, it's not going to be a pinpoint exact answer, but it's mainly just doing stuff you like for you. It's, and just have fun, because I think so many people, as you'll read in most magic forums, get, you know, take it so seriously.
They do.
You know, and I love magic probably more than most, but equally you have to see it's kind of, you know, we're all just telling our own little fun lies, right? So it's just a way to make them more fun, and just do it for you. That's the main takeaway, is just do it for fun, do it for you.
That's great advice. And let's talk about you as a creator, because that's something that you're very well known for across the whole of the magic community. When did that come about? I think the first time you fell on my radar as a creator was bringing out a DVD with RSVP. Is that right? Did you bring out, you bought out an RS,
was it RSVP? Yeah, I've done two with Russ. So he was, so again, so where sort of Mark comes in, I think he helped get that opportunity, which is so thankful for that. So yeah, I did two DVDs with Russ. One was Charge Shark, that was my very first one. And then Chartistry was the second. It was it's a weird thing. I've never liked the label creator, because I wouldn't consider myself to be a magic creator, as you know, the label you use may suggest. You know, guys like Nicholas Lawrence and stuff like that, and you know, all the people that do like consulting stuff for like Dynamo and those sort of teams, I consider those more to be the magic creator types, like the consultants. But for me, it's, I remember watching David Stone on one of his DVDs, or it might have been an interview, I can't remember, but he said that you know, he wasn't the most creative guy, but he was a great magical adapter. So from that was always the kind of lens I've seen it for myself. I wouldn't consider myself to be a great creator at all. I've just taken, because I've got a very particular style. Like I love, you know, visual card magic that, you know, sometimes emphasizes or borders on more flourishing visual. That's kind of changing over time, but because I've got that very particular aesthetic, any card trick that I push into that kind of funnel, it's gonna change the appearance to most things. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's the ability to create, it's just finding stuff and just doing it the way I'd want to perform, if that makes sense. So it's just adapting it to my very particular view of how magic should be performed with cards. So it's more a stylistic choice.
And could you show us something on one of those early DVD sets that you brought out?
Sure. Yeah. So
I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but I also see you have a pack of cards in your hand. So,
of course, yeah. Well, I haven't had a chance to practice all day, so it's just been this is kind of my practice time as well as that. So I'll show you one of my favorite sandwich routines. So I placed the pack there. You can just see the top of my head. So I'm going to use four kings at this point. You can see those. Can you see those, all right?
Yes.
Yep. I'll pop those there. And Craig, would you say stop wherever you wish?
Stop.
Okay, memorize this card.
Got it.
Now watch if this goes in the center of the pack. Now, didn't do anything funny at this point. Your card is somewhere in the center of the deck. And this, everything is extremely clear. You see the pack, you see the kings. They've not gone anywhere near each other. If I snap, you'll see one card will actually jump between the kings. Maybe it should be your nine of hearts, yes?
Yes.
Not bad. No, that's okay, but you expect me to find that. It's literally my job, right? If we go through them and show you the nine, we'll try something a little different. If you, this would usually be done with pre-pandemic, they would lift up the pack, place a card anywhere they want. You can see no funny moves again. Now, all we do this time is place the kings on top of the deck, and you can see we place them in the center like this. We wait just a second. You can see they jump back to the top with one card between them. Lo and behold, it should be that nine. Now, the thing is, you've seen the same trick twice. Obviously, that kind of takes away the surprise. There's a rule in magic to say you can't do the same trick twice, but not once, so you can't do the same trick backwards. It's a weird thing, right? So watch, if you see the card, it's going to vanish.
Wow.
Gone. I know. Thanks for the sarcasm, Craig. Now, if we if you look, you can see it genuinely has gone from here. So it looks like we have the one, two, three, and four kings. So if the card has gone from here, Craig, it must go somewhere. So you notice we just have the kings, and I carry one card in my inside pocket. You see me go anywhere near there?
No, not at all.
Nope, should be one if we blow. That's when you get the four kings, and over here should be that nine of hearts. So that was a slight variation of one of the routines on my very first DVD, Charge Shark, which is called Kickback Bonanza, and I still do it, yeah, all the time. It's
routine.
Sorry, my camera's got a little awkward there. Perfect.
That's great. That's a beautiful routine there, Devin.
Thank you very much.
Great. Here's a question. You are obviously technically very gifted. You've spent a lot of time practicing and learning moves. How important is it to have a big sort of breadth of knowledge when it comes to card moves? Is it that important, or you know, it's that age old question, you know, sleights versus gaffs. Where do you kind of fall with that?
So I think the problem with most magicians is they even make that a distinction in the first place. You know, every move is just a tool to achieve a particular objective, whether it's to control a card to the top, middle, bottom, left hand, right hand, you know, whatever the goal of that particular sleight is. If if the trick you're trying to do need, there are certain things that you can do with gaffs that you just can't replicate with sleight of hand. I'm aware of that. I think most people are. I think it's a fairly basic assumption, right? But also there are certain moves that gaffs just can't replicate as well. You know, like you see all of these versions of like card to wallet with gaff cards and stuff, where it's a deceptive palm and a load in the wallet is just as, if not better. And I think it's the stance I've always had on it is I've never understood why you shy away from either approach. I think because the more knowledge you have in general about magic, so whether it's you don't have to know about the history of every move, although the history is important and it's fun to know the lineage of where you've come, if you've invented something, like where it comes in and who's invented it, just, you know, you're not reinventing the wheel, but it can take you in different directions as well. But I think it's important to learn as much as you can, in terms of everything, in terms of sleight of hand, gaffs, performance, how the two work synergistically together. But it's why you wouldn't learn more tools for your trade. I just don't understand why you wouldn't. And you know, you hear so many people say, "Oh, it's all move monkeys." And the problem is with those sort of statements is if it wasn't for most of the card sites that working magicians use were created by quote unquote move monkeys. You know, like the sandwich that everyone uses. That's Ed Marlowe, you know, and he's one of the most prolific card creators, arguably of all time. The same with the tilt, Di Vernon, you know, most of his double lifts, variations on the second deal, like so many of the subtleties that these guys created, you know, are in everyone's repertoire now. And if it wasn't for people like that, and it's the breadth of knowledge, because the more you know, the more you can create, the more directions you can take what you already do in. So I think it's not only good from you need to know your craft and you should be learning as much as you can about everything you can. I think it should be part of the journey of mastery with magic. I think it shouldn't be put up on a pedestal, because it's not, you know, but equally it shouldn't be something that's discriminated on because people view it as people learning it just for move monkeys. I think it's often you get this kind of discrimination from professionals and hobbyists. Mm-hmm. It's like they both do magic. You know, it's the same with mentalists that say, you know, mind reading with cards isn't, you know, mind or mind magic or whatever that weird bloody distinction is. It's like all of it is just magic. You know, it's not, you can call mentalism is not a separate area, it's a subsection of magic in general. Mm. And, you know, same with sleights and gaffs, they're all just part of a much bigger conversation. I think it's important to know about all of them, but it depends on what your end goal is. Like if you just want to learn about them all, you know, fill your boots, just read everything and just play with as much as you can. And if you want to perform, find stuff that works for you. And equally, you never know when that move might be handy. There have been so many situations where a very particular move, you know, I found myself in a very almost panoramic situation where like there's all people around me. And if I was to do something like a diagonal palm shift, people would see it from behind or the sides. So it's important to do a move that you could achieve the same objective from the deck being flat and, you know, either like under the spread or something like that. And it still allow you to achieve the same end result. But, if I always stuck to the same six moves, you're screwed, you know?
Absolutely. And here's a question for you.
Sure.
On that subject, but also slightly different. And this is a question that's been asked in magic for many, many years. To flourish or not to flourish? You said at the beginning, when you first got into magic, you did flourishes, but you didn't do magic.
Yeah.
I know from gigging with you, your magic is still very flourishy, but it doesn't take over from the magic. It's kind of, it's there alongside it. Where would you say, do flourishes have a part in modern magic? And if so,
oh, completely.
In what way? Yeah.
Sure. I think it's, I think that the baseline for the conversation is that where we are in magic now, we're at an interesting point because people are so exposed to magic. There's so much magic online, so much magic in person, so much magic on TV, you know, or viral videos, etc. The overall expectation of what people think you can do versus what you in reality can do is, you know, there's a huge disparity. And I think it may have been a lot easier to be what is perceived to be a great magician from a layperson's perspective prior to the, you know, the expanding of like social media and stuff like that, because they had no reference points from which to judge you. And now the problem, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a problem. If anything, it's probably a great unique opportunity is that, you know, all of the best magicians in the world are regularly being featured on things like Fool Us and online, you know, getting hired by companies to show like the best they can do. So every time people are being exposed to magic, they're being exposed to like some of the best in our industry doing obviously the best stuff they can do. So that sets the benchmark very, very high. So to be an average, to be a good magician nowadays takes a hell of a lot more work to practice, to refine, to get your magic to the point where it can be withstand visual scrutiny and to be at that level. Whereas, you know, say 10, 20 years ago, you could have got away with maybe a little, being a bit more slack in some respects. I forgot the question. Where were we?
Flourishing, not to flourish.
Yes, sure. Yeah, yeah. We're going off on a huge, huge bloody tangent. I don't know how the hell we got there. Very philosophical. No, so yeah, flourish is magic. I think it has, it's a stylistic choice. You know, I see it from the point of view that when someone experiences magic, or they know they're going to see a magician, or if they see me or whoever, there's a certain preconception of you being an expert. Obviously, because if you're in front of them performing, you're in the position of power in some respects, right? So they deem you with a certain level of expertise. So I think for me, I just thought I'd hit that head on. It's like, if they expect me to be an expert of a deck of cards, I would demonstrate my expertise with a deck of cards. And I think it's because so many shy away from it or stray away from like flourishy card magic for it being deemed as too hard, or which it really, really isn't. You know, it's just a stylistic choice. It's no better or worse than any other. I think it suits me because I've always loved, you know, like skateboarding and stuff like that, all the kind of visual aesthetics with that. I've always loved cardistry and card flourishes, etc. I don't do too much of that stuff nowadays, but that still has it's very much a manual. So you can see that the magic is working from my hands. You know, I don't believe it's any wrong or right, but I think it does have a place in modern magic currently, especially with, I noticed the difference from doing normal card stuff and then performing flourishy card magic. Reactions were so much better. Yeah, it's just stuck with me ever since. Mm.
That's great.
I think it's just because it's not something that people ever see. Mm. Generally, you know, it's still a fairly unique way to handle cards, I suppose, in some respects, because most want to hide the skill, whereas I think on certain moments in the performance, I will, you know, stand back and I still mess with putting different levels of flourishes in. Some sets I might not do any. It's, you know, very much a stylistic choice, but yeah.
That's great. Now, going back to you as a creator, obviously we talked about what you brought out through your RSVP. You've also brought out many, many books and other projects, but recently your name's been linked with Penguin Magic, the largest magic shop in the world, which is amazing. You know, it's absolutely, and they flew you over to America.
They did, yeah.
And you got a chance to do a Penguin Live. What was that whole experience like? Are the guys with Penguin, are they good to work with? Is the question.
Sure. So yeah, they were absolutely, as far as teams go, like they're such a such great hosts. They're amazing, super fun personalities, and obviously there's so many. Basically, when you see a Penguin Live, you see the end polished result, but there are so many different people that have so many different roles to make it look like such an end the end product looked as polished as it does. Nick Lacapo is a great magician who's, you know, got along really, really well because his just loved his style and sense of humor. Like he was the opening act the night that we is basically the, I don't know whether people know, is that they've got like one of the longest running magic shows because it's every Tuesday, and that, you know, they've got a new lecturer coming in from like around the world, you know, different people, most of like the best in their particular area of magic. And the experience was great because you perform the material you're going to teach for a real audience. So it's, you know, gives everyone a chance to see what that works in person. And it was just really fun to perform alongside those people. But in terms of like, what was the experience like? It was probably one of my top five, I think, experiences, not only because the team was so fun and it was great to see and connect with magicians from around the world. And obviously, you know, the exposure of a Penguin Live is great because it opens up many opportunities, much like this, I suppose. Yay. but equally, it was just a great kind of foot in the door to, if any other projects want to do in the future, it's something that we can potentially explore there. But it was for me a real kind of humble full circle moment, because I'd always loved the Penguin lectures, and again, same with what we were talking about earlier, like the opportunities. It was a very long, slow burn. I mean, to get from the idea of I really want to do a Penguin lecture to the actuality of it, you know, it was years of like mentioning it to the team, and then it's kind of just like knowing the right people at the right time, or and not being afraid to ask a question. It was I'm sure I won't mind me saying, but Ian Rowland put in a great word for me, you know, the Penguin team. And it's having someone that can, if you've got the material and you're confident that you've got stuff that's different, you know, it's just having a way in, I suppose. But yeah, the experience was great. It was because from that has allowed me to connect with loads more magicians. You know, I have a really tiny social media following in comparative terms to a lot of the social media influencers in the magic space, but the people that do follow me, like, you know, really like my stuff. And it's like the Kevin Kelly 1,000 True Fans thing. The idea of just, you know, it's not necessarily about the quantity of people follow you, but the quality of the followers you have. Mm-hmm. And it's great because most of them are passionate card magicians. And for some reason, it's just a certain synergistic, it tends to attract a very particular type of person, I find. And they're just great to connect with and great to talk to.
That's awesome. And here's one for you. I'm going to put you on the spot again.
Let's do it.
You perform something that you have put out with Penguin. Something maybe that you taught in the act or something else. Have you got something that you could show us?
Sure. Yeah. I'll so I'll show you the version of the Biddle trick, which is probably one of my favorite ones. So can you see the cards there okay?
Yeah, I can see them fine.
Sure. So I'll get you so we just say this would be the selection in this case. It doesn't matter if I say it. The card would be lost in the center of the pack. So I say to the spectators, this is actually the very first card trick that got me into magic. I can still feel the nostalgia. I still feel the room, the card that I used, everything. Now, I want to give you roughly the same sort of feeling that I had when I first got into magic. So I want to give you, a small bit of that experience. So hopefully, because this might create some awesome opportunities for you. So you're going to help me find the card. So the card is somewhere in the pack. Would you say stop anywhere you wish?
Stop.
Okay, so I'm going to place roughly where you said stop. So you can see, your card, I've been trying to follow it as closely as I can. I believe it's in this top group. I'm going to show you these one at a time. So if you do see your card, keep a complete expressionless face. Just like that one. Just great. So you have the, that looks like you've got gas. So you've got the two of diamonds, the 10 of clubs. We have the five of hearts. We have the six of diamonds. And we also have the king of spades. Did you see, or more importantly, did you hear your card among those?
Yes.
Excellent. Now, great. I'm going to do this extremely slow. I'm going to remove one of them and flip the pack over. As you can see, as we show you these cards, you shouldn't see your card face up.
Nope.
No? That's a 1 in 5 chance. That's okay. 20%. So yours was the five of hearts, yes?
Yes.
Perfect. So we'll try this watch. We'll show you something that defies explanation. If I take the card, it's going to look like it vanishes from here. So we're left with 1, 2, 3, and 4 cards. Your card is nowhere to be seen. Now, bear in mind, this would usually be the deck in their hand the entire time. As you say, these cards have been in your palm. You take them from the spectator and show that you spread through roughly to the center of the pack is one card. Face down, that's the name of the card, and show, in fact, is the 5 of hearts. Yeah. So that is Thank you. Yeah, so it's a trick. It's probably one of my go-to. If you came up to me and said, "Oh, would you show me a card trick?" You know, either out in the real world, so to speak, that'd probably be the thing I'd show you. Just, I think it covers so many bases of what a great magic trick is.
It's awesome. And here's a question.
Sure.
How I know you said that you're not a creator, but you have, I'm not going to use the word create, but you have developed a lot of magic tricks over the years.
Sure. Okay.
What process? We have a lot of people on this channel that really want to create their own magic. Sure. They want to develop their own, you know, their own routines that are unique to them. What advice would you give somebody that wants to actually create magic that's original to them? You know, where would you start? What's your creative process is what I'm trying to say, I think.
Sure. I think it's a lot more chaotic than maybe the kind of soundbite answer that you may want. It feels like there's not a kind of set process for, which is really bad. In some respects, it depends when it comes to each trick or move or thing I want to create, it tends to start from a different point. So in general terms, something that's helped me in creating new stuff is again, like you said, having the knowledge to know what's come before me. So learning a lot about, learning a lot of the card magic that's been published by like Vernon, Marlowe, exposing myself, watching as much card magic as I can. Exposing yourself is wrong. Don't do that. That's really bad. So watching as much card magic as I can, attending like conventions, lectures, learning like as much as you can, as much knowledge as you can kind of process in your head. So once you have, because all I see magic creation as is just problem solving in some respect, you know, so dependent on the problem you want to solve will dictate the nature of the way that you approach the problem. So if it's, like Tommy Wonder in his amazing Books of Wonder talks about in one of his essays that you've got like a dream effect. If you could, hold your hand out and the effect you wanted to have was a golden egg appears on your hand. Okay, that's the end point. That's the place you want to get to, right? So we know that the laws of physics stop that trick looking as clean as I envision it in my head, right? So the next thing we think of, well, what's the next, not the next best thing, but like if that's the 100% goal, what's like the 95% that I could get to make it at least replicate the same image in my head? And then it's just working with the knowledge you have, the constraints. I think that brings up an interesting point as well. Like the more constraints you have, like the more that can be a really good thing in some respects. Like whether it's only using one move to create an effect, or whether it's using two moves, or you can only use one move once, or you can only use a one particular gaff, or you take an old gaff and apply it to this new trick. You know, just all of these different things. And 90% of what you create will probably be crap. You know, it's most of it will be really, really bad. But each bit has its merit, because you might create something now, stick it in your notebook, and then 20 years down the line that might be the perfect solution for a trick that you want to create. So I say have a notebook, document everything you create, and I think starting from the point of creating to just be original in most magicians, I think when the way that they frame that question, at least for me, how I interpret that is that they want to create something original to sell to other magicians. And it's like, I think that's the complete wrong way to approach it. You know, it's and I think for me it's just problem solving. You know, creation should be playtime. It should be something that you just have fun. There's no end result, and just explore every avenue you can go down. You know, if try the trick backwards, if you're doing a triumph, why not start with that and then end up with a deck that's messed up? You know, there's so many different I think it's having an open mind. Like that, I think it's just losing that rigidity that you have when you first get into it. I mean, you know, as a guy, you've created shitloads of magic. Do you have any other tips that you could, how do you create?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. How do I create? Well, this isn't about me. Good grief. But yeah, I what I tend to do is I tend to, very similar to you, I have an idea in my head as to what I want to achieve.
Sure.
And I kind of reverse engineer that. So very similar to what you said. I think that the hardest part of creativity is finding that initial spark of an idea.
Sure.
Figuring out something that hasn't been done before. Oh, well, and I think you have to be open to, you have to be open for understanding that that inspiration can strike at any time. You know, it isn't necessarily, and if you're constantly thinking, oh, I need to find a new idea, I need to find a new idea, that's precisely when it won't happen. But, you know, I mean, we've all been there where we've walked around somewhere like Staples and we've seen something, we're like, now I have an idea. It happened to me. I did a video recently on the channel about creativity, and I was talking about these Harry Potter coins that I found online, and they all had different Harry Potter characters, and I saw them and I immediately thought, if I applied some basic coin magic to those, there's so much you could do. And I think it's just being open. It's being open to allowing inspiration to hit you at any time.
I guess it's and also kind of gamifying the process, right? Like you see a lot of, well, certainly when it comes to creativity the problem is it's such a kind of elusive and ethereal thing. There's no, you know, some people just have more original ideas than others. That's probably a fact. It's not to say that you can get close to that, you know, with time, the right process. And, you know, it's the same with anything. It's just having the, once you've got enough knowledge in that, you can expand your knowledge, because it's basically like, with the more you know, the more you realize you don't know.
Yeah. Just
kind of applying that to magic in some respects. It's like the more, it's just exposing yourself to different possibilities to, like you said about the applying like card likes to different objects or to other card shaped objects, you know, like crackers or business cards or, you know, taking the cards off and making them different cartoons or, you know, whatever. That's such a simple and basic, you know, benign version, but it can be fun to, other good ways that have worked fun for me is having like a group of friends that you regularly jam with magic wise. And obviously the beauty of, you know, this conversation and others is the fact that you can do that with magicians from around the world. You know, it doesn't need to be. So just having someone say, right, for this week, the topic is collectors, you know, and then you all go away, create whatever version, and you then come back the next week and you see, you know, seven different versions. You might not like any of them, but the fact that you've seen how different people approach a problem gives you some sort of insight into their creative process. That can be a good way as well. Is if you have, it's not just, you know, they say imitation is the best form of flattery, right? Is that the, no.
Imitation is sincerest form of flattery.
Yes, exactly. That's it. So I think if you can, not necessarily create magic how your favorite creators would, but use the idea that springs to mind is it was kind of hard to articulate for a moment, was Stuart James. So he you know, creates so much amazing original card magic in his head, essentially. So he had a which sounds like crazy when you speak about it, but he had a basically like an invisible panel of like imaginary friends, right? There's like three or four people, I forget how many, but he would create these crazy, like really, really intricate, like stack-based things without a deck of cards in his hand, just all in his mind. And it's just that level of, that's probably bordering on like mild psychosis, but using, right, for us normal blokes, right? If you've got like, so we all have probably four or five different creators or, you know, magicians that we really, really like their stuff, whether it's, you know, Pepe Caro, Juan Tamaris, whatever your particular bunch of people is when you approach a problem, it's like, well, how would they approach it? You know, how would Danny D'Ortiz approach this? How would Craig Petty approach this problem? And then using those as training tools, you know, just to see, what would Craig do in this situation that I wouldn't, you know, vice versa. And I think it's, and a good bit of advice I was given is always go to lectures that you know you wouldn't like.
Very good point.
Yeah, just because basically the ones that you would never go to in Blackpool are probably the ones you'd gain the most from. I got told off for not going to one about, I think it's like emceeing or something like that. Like, and I, the guys wouldn't tell me the stuff that he covered, but they said like it was an amazing workshop on like how to hold an audience with just your voice and stuff like that, you know. So I think it's, and it's, yeah, just have fun with it. Like creation should be fun. This should be, and it's, and realize that an idea is never done, you know. I think that's the,
and it's okay to revisit past plots. Like if you actually think about one of my favorite magicians, Tommy Wonder, the three things he's most known for is a cups and balls routine, a wild card, and a card in box. Three plots that have been done to death, but he took it and he stamped his own personality on it and created his own version and became famous for it.
And that's it. I think it's, you know, you've encapsulated my my long, tedious waffle into what it should be. Add your own stamp to whatever trick you're creating and it will become original to you. It's if, you know, if you present something that you really like and it's authentic to how you create, it's going to be different.
Yep.
You know, if someone said to me, create a coin trick or create a card trick, it's going to be different to how you would do it. Mm-hmm. Just from how we perform. So I think it's, again, I think people tend to overcomplicate the process. You know, there's no point sitting there postulating about it. Just get on with it and just bloody try it.
I completely agree. And I've got a question for you. I ask this question to everybody I interview. And I want to know, especially from you, what's next?
Sure.
You've been performing, as you said, from 18. You've spent 11 years at Illusions. You're a successful magician in your own right. I know we've all had a bit of a setback with COVID-19, but you're a very successful magician. You're linked with Smoke and Mirrors, the number one magic bar in the UK. You've worked with Penguin. You've worked with RSVP. You've created and published books that are books and routines that are highly regarded around the whole of the magic community. You're in your early 30s. What's on the bucket list?
That's horrible to hear. Because it's literally 2 years ago. That was in the 20s, man. Where's the time go? No, don't worry. It's what's next? That's a great question. I think it's I think at this moment it's just so uncertain. I've got a few things that I'd like to do in terms of, I've probably got enough material for another online lecture that would, so basically my idea is to publish everything that I haven't, not just for the sake of publishing it, just because I want to get it all out of my head and then essentially go back to being like a student of magic again. Do you know what I mean? To take like a 5-year period of, to basically publish everything I've got stuck in, you know, the recesses of my brain, get it all out there. You know, as to what form that would take, I don't know. Most likely probably going to be a series of like online downloads and online lecture. Long term, I'd love to do like a big sort of hardback book. In the long term, you know, that'll be you know, just publish probably my magnum opus like once when I'm happy, probably a good 10 years off, yeah. Because I'm still developing as a, you know, performer and a creator myself. And still kind of crystallizing the theories that I want to put out in some respects. So like an online lecture book, maybe. I want to explore different formats of doing shows. I've not done any like Zoom shows, so I'm trying to add something. It'd be fun to add something unique to that. But yeah, other than that, man, it's just when and if the opportunity comes back to perform magic full time again, jump back in as soon as I can in terms of finding the right sort of balance with that.
You know, and let's very quickly touch on that before we wrap things up. Like, for those people that are watching this in years to come, this is being filmed in October 2020. And the world's
going to
be...
Strange time.
Yeah.
Just about.
You know, what advice would you give? You know, I see magicians, and I'm sure you do as well, that are leaving magic behind. They've decided that this is magic's dead, it's never going to happen again. Then you see people that are really positive that are like, well, no, of course it's going to come back. What, it's not going to be like forever. My question is twofold. Where are you falling with that? I know you're a very positive person, so I can guess. And then secondly, what do you do to, you know, you've probably seen, like I have, there's magicians that are going online and they're saying, oh, I've not picked up a pack of cards in 6 months. I've not performed in 6 months. I don't know if I still have my love for magic. And I know that you, like me, aren't like that at all. So what advice can you give people in terms of making sure that they still have that passion and where your thought process in terms of where we are and when we're going to be?
Yeah, I think, the truth be told, no one knows where we are, where we're going to be, right? I think this is going to be the new normal I think the projections of when any form of normality will come back are probably a little bit optimistic in some respects. Some people saying it would be like a year before gigs come back in any, you know, normal respect. I think it's probably going to be like three to five, maybe. I think there will be trickles of stuff coming back, but as to what it was like before, you know, before the pandemic, I think it's probably going to be about 3 or 4 years maybe before anything comes back. But for me, it's highlighted the kind of practicalities of having magic as my only income in some respects. It's like, I absolutely loved it that time, but knowing that the industry can be taken away so quick, you know, it's made me think that it might be, you know, the time to look at a different career in some respects. But I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing. I think it's, I always had that kind of magician elitist attitude in some respects that, you know, if I was only doing magic as my full-time income, that made me a credible full-time performer. Whereas, you know, you're missing out on so many kind of income opportunities from other different areas that I don't think it has to be your exclusive thing. So my focus is going to be trying to, you know, diversify and get different kind of income streams to weather the bad storm in some respects. But as you mentioned, my predictions are probably rather optimistic on where it's going to go and how. But with regards to the question of keeping enthusiasm, I mean, every now and again, it could be good to have a break. You know, it doesn't necessarily, for me, I find that kind of a weird notion to even think about, you know, having a break from magic just because I love it so much. But I don't think you have to get out of it, but just change what you're doing within it. So, you know, I was always learning commercial stuff, but I've spent time going back through like the Steve 40 books and, you know, all of the like really, really technical card stuff that got me into card magic at the start, and going back to learning stuff that just interests me purely for its own sake, not for the sake of performing it, and just reading books, watching great performers, just thinking. I think the thing I miss the most is like the jam sessions, like, because for me, those are the best parts about magic, I think. But when it comes to, you know, gaining your mojo back in magic, just take some time out if you need to. If not, just go back to what got you into it in the first place. And I think if your level of interest in magic is being dictated by the you know, the kind of professional constraints of gigging, then I question the level of interest to even start with. You know, if you can give up magic just because you can't earn money from it anymore, that, to me, that doesn't seem like the passion was really there in the first place. If it's just a commercial vehicle, because I think even the people that say that do love magic more than they let on, that they've developed a weird kind of bias, you know, where they say that if I'm not earning money, or the, you know, the guys that say, I don't do tricks unless I'm getting paid, is like, you know, I can see that, but equally it's just like, I don't know, just keeping that passion alive, man. Like, maybe get some tattoos of card stuff up here. I don't know.
Basically, yeah, exactly.
I was going to say, last time I swear we met, your arm was like, I think you had like the ESP symbols and nothing else.
Oh, no, you're completely painted now. In fact, I'm doing a video tomorrow on what all of my tattoos and what they mean. People keep asking me, because there's 30 tricks on there. They all have a reason. So
that's epic, man.
So they all have stupidity, I think. It's midlife crisis. Some people get a Ferrari, I get tattoos, so, you know.
I still live at home, man, so I ain't got that. My midlife crisis would be about 60, I think. I'm maturing a lot slower than other people.
No, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show, mate. Can we sign off with one last card trick? Would that be okay?
Here
right now, I would kill myself if I can't get Daniel Char to perform one more card trick, if that's okay.
Think of yourself as a bit too melodramatic for too much of a Hamlet feel for a card trick, right?
Put it this way, Ryan would probably kill me because he loves you. He loves watching you perform. So
that's very kind. It's nice to know that I amuse kids. So you can see, I'll try this. I'm going to do, basically I'm going to start off the trick with the ending in mind, if that makes sense. So I'm going to go through and use a random card. So we use this case, the 10 of spades. I'm going to use the 10 to help me find a couple of cards. In this case, the two jacks. So you can see the two jacks here. Now we're going to try something a little different with them, because this is the end result that we wanted to create with your 10 sandwiched between the jacks. We're going to try and do this slight difference. So I leave the card probably near the middle. And this time, the moment the jacks come near the deck, they're going to vanish. So you see the cards like this. Yep, kind of 1, 2, 3. Looks like they vanish straight into the center of the pack with one card between them. Hopefully it should be the 10 of spades. Now, that's the first part, the card getting between them. But imagine we could do something a little different. So rather than use the jacks to find the card, we're going to use the card to find the jacks. So similar to what we did at the start, the jacks can be sent like this. And if you watch the 10, the instant jump back between them, that should be the card between the jacks. So it's just a little fun doodle.
That's great.
Slash magic exercise. It's a fun, fun little thing. But yeah, you can see the 10 vanishes, leaving us with the jacks, which means, Craig, in my pocket should be the...
I just don't know. The 10.
The jacks. Oh. And then the 10's over.
Oh, man.
Oh. Thank you, Babel. That's a great...
Man, you're so good. You really are. Actually, that's made me think of one last question before you sign
sure.
up. Do you have any... you've mentioned several times about practice, and practice should be fun, and you know, I know a lot of magicians that don't look at practice as fun. Have you got any tips on how to practice to make it more enjoyable?
Yes, practice is a weird thing. I mean, it's a hugely kind of personal endeavor, I think, in some respects. I know some people that really advocate the practice of having like a video camera, you know, going through routines and then watching it back. So a much more kind of scholastic and almost academic approach to practice, which it, for me, seems a little bit over the top sometimes. I will film stuff now and again just for Instagram or the odd little video for Facebook. Nowhere near as regular as I should, but I'm lazy, right? But in terms of practice, I think it's having different. I've got several different approaches. Most of the time, I don't have any form of structured practice, but I always have a deck of cards in my hands. So it will be, you know, if we're watching telly and it's a girlfriend's put a crap program on, I don't like, you know, just practice some stuff, mainly moves. I usually sequence moves together. So it could be a certain slide that I want to work on. I'll just, that'll just take up all my attention and I'll work on that one thing. If I want to work on several card effects at once, I'll make a list of, let's just say 4, 5, or 6, or find 6 routines that make like a really long monster routine that, you know, probably takes like 10, 15 minutes to work through. But so I'll have like effect 1 that leads into effect 2, into effect 3. So basically it's got like each setup leads me into the next one, et cetera, et cetera. So it's almost creating like a mini act in some respects. But every time that I do that performance, I'm practicing 7 tricks, if that makes sense. So it's just by running through, it's just creating a list and just rinsing and repeats. You start off with 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, then 5. Just running through that again and again and again. Different forms of practice could be, if you've got a very specific goal, just, you know, for a show, practicing your show. That can always be a fun one as well. It's because you find that is the more you do your show, the more you get kind of complacent, right, in some respects, whereas by trying new stuff with that as well, it's always, like I said, always toying with different ideas. It's always, you know, how can I make this fun? How can I add an extra kicker to this effect? What? It's just mixing practice with creation and just enjoying the process, man. It's more of a form of like meditation for me, you know. It's like, it's never a chore.
That's just great advice. It really is. Daniel, you have been amazing. Like I said at the very beginning of the program, really wanted to get you on this, and I'm so glad I have. Where can people get your stuff? Do you have your own online store that people can go to?
I don't know. I'm really lazy. I probably should. No, basically, if you want to check out my Penguin Live, you can we'll give you the link which you can post on the website. So for my Penguin Live lecture, you can get it from me direct or from Penguin. You can
How
also
would
check
people get
out.
hold of you direct? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, you can just shoot me a message on Facebook. I'm on it quite a lot, so generally respond on there. Or if you're on Instagram, message me at Daniel Chard Magic, just all one word. That's probably the place you'll between that and Facebook, you'll find me most often. Or I'm probably like yourself. I need to my YouTube game, do some stuff on YouTube. You can find my YouTube channel fairly easy. Type in Daniel Chard Magic.
I'll link the YouTube channel down below as well. I'll put all of your socials
Yeah,
down at the bottom.
sure. Yeah, but mainly, if you have enjoyed the stuff you've seen today, I'd say check out the live lecture just because that covers all of my kind of working stuff, and it's yeah, I think it's the best value for money of any project I've done as well, because you get my lecture notes with it as well. So,
Perfect. That's absolutely brilliant. Daniel, thank you very much for being on the show. It's
no,
been
dude, no problem.
You let me see, where are we? So next week we've got Sean Farquhar, I think. So that'll be fun. And I'm back tomorrow with another review show with Ryland. And guys, don't forget to subscribe to the channel. We put 14 videos up every single week. So I'll see you again tomorrow. Thanks very much, Daniel. You were awesome. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic,
Be
magic.
sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel,
Magic TV,
which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.